Hi, everyone. My name is Matt. And I just wanted this morning look at a passage of the Gospels and just focus on this story. And it is a story that we actually looked at a couple of years ago, but I want to revisit it because there is so much there. And frankly, it's one of the reasons why I love Jesus. Now, the challenge with this series, I didn't know this going into it, but now I know this because I learn, is I can't just give you a bunch of reasons and say, here's all the reasons why we should love Jesus. Because with that, you go, those are good, and I should love Jesus. But that doesn't get to our hearts. Instead, what we've got to do is, and I can't do this by myself, is see more clearly who Jesus actually is, as the gospel writers tell us. And that would actually, once we see that, we'd be so compelled, we'd be so drawn, that love would be the byproduct of that. And so I'm going to share some insights and some commentary from a New Testament scholar named Dr. Conrad Genf. So I want to give him credit. And I'm just trusting that God meets us where we are as we walk through this story. We just got back from a retreat with the staff Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And so I am in like retreat mode. I don't even know what that means other than just feeling a little slower, a little, like I wish we could just, in this lodge, just circle up some couches and sit and just talk about Jesus. So I'm going to try to do that in a different format. So Mark, chapter 5, if you have a Bible, we're going to spend the whole time here in verses 21 to 43. Starting in verse 21. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders, named Jairus, came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So this is amazing. This synagogue leader, which means he's a Pharisee, he falls at Jesus' feet, and he says, "Please come." He begs Jesus, "Put your hands on my daughter so that she'll be healed and live." Now, this leader of the synagogue, Jairus, it's fair to say that he probably doesn't understand everything about Jesus. He probably kind of has an idea of who Jesus is, but not a full picture. We know for sure that his fellow Pharisees, his colleagues, they had some real hang-ups with Jesus at this point. So this is pretty remarkable that he's willing to come to Jesus. This is Mark chapter 5. And if you've read, you know, if you're reading along as Mark intended, kind of the whole thing at once. In Mark chapter 3, already by that point, the Pharisees are like, this guy Jesus is possessed by Satan. And they began to plot already in Mark 3 how to kill Jesus. And so the climate toward Jesus at this point from the Pharisees is not warm. This is the public stance of the Pharisees toward Jesus. They don't think very highly of him. And of course, Jairus, he's heard all the talk. He's heard all the whispering. He knows all of this at this point. And so, of course, he realizes politically, this is not a good move. My colleagues are going to be upset with me. You know, frankly, I should know better than to fall for Jesus like the ignorant masses. But if you're a parent, you can relate to this. Forget about religious controversy. You can forget about political danger when your daughter is dying. If you've ever had a health scare, if you've ever been on like the brink of financial ruin and how scary that is, if you've had a marriage crisis or you've hit rock bottom in some way, you know what that desperation will do, right? Like, I'll do anything to fix this. And so Jairus goes, I just have this sense, for the sake of my daughter, who I would do anything for, that it's worth the risk. It's worth the risk to my reputation. It's worth the shame and the embarrassment and whatever fallout happens because of this. And he falls at Jesus' feet. I'll do anything. I've heard enough. I know enough about you, Jesus, to know that if there's anyone who can do something for my daughter, it's you. And of course, Jesus goes, ha, you're a Pharisee. you're one of the guys in the background plotting to kill me. You're one of the people who's constantly making my life more difficult, and now you want my help. Interesting. No, verse 24. So Jesus went with him. Wait, what? You will? Yeah, sure. I'll go with you. I mean, what a surprising verse. Essentially, Jesus did what he was told. That's amazing. Jesus did what he was asked. It's actually not that simple. I wish it was. How many of you know that Jesus doesn't always do what you want him to do? Now, there are actually two miracles intertwined, like woven together in this one story. And the first miracle involves Jairus and his daughter. And then there's a second one that we're getting ready for right now. And as we watch these two stories unfold, I think they teach two very simple, but I think profound points at the same time. The first is that Jesus is actually willing to do what you want. As in, he's for you. He's on your side. You don't have to like talk him into stuff. He's willing to do what you want. But what we also see is that Jesus doesn't always do what you want him to do. He's willing, but he doesn't always do what we want. In fact, there are a couple of examples of this tension. If you're reading Mark up to this point, there's a scene in Mark chapter 2 where a man with leprosy comes to Jesus and falls on his knees and says, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." And Mark says, at this, Jesus was, and the word is, indignant. And he's not indignant at the man. He's indignant at the thought that he wouldn't be willing. He goes, "If I'm willing? If? Of course I'm willing." And he says, "Be clean," and the man's healed. But again, Jesus doesn't always do it. In the scene right before this passage, Jesus heals a demon-possessed man. He sets him free. And the man, Mark says, begs to go with Jesus. And you know what Jesus says? No. You're healed, you're free, but no. Stay here among your own people and tell them what God has done for you. Jesus is willing, but he doesn't always do what we want him to do. And the same thing here in Mark chapter 5. He's willing, and so he agrees to go with Jairus, except not exactly like Jairus was thinking. A large crowd, he goes with him, a large crowd followed and pressed around him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him, like he's got an Apple Watch with a little power meter. I don't know, he somehow knew. He turned around. Time out. What happened to Jairus? Did you guys forget about him already? What is Jairus doing in this part of the story? I mean, he goes to Jesus, frantic and desperate. And amazingly, Jesus agrees to go lay his hands on Jairus' dying daughter. So there's like this glimmer of hope for this distraught father, only if they get on it. Right? There's not a lot of time. And then what happens? The crowd, the delay, like the two of them are trying to push their way through to Jairus' house as planned. And all of a sudden, Jesus stops in the middle of the crowd. And Jesus is going to say, "Who touched me?" Real casual like that. And the disciples are going to say, "What do you mean, who touched you? You're in a whole crowd of people." So if you're Jairus, what are you doing? Anybody? Thank you. I can only assume that was Steve. You're freaking out. You're going, "Come on, come on, come on. My daughter doesn't have long. The clock is ticking. I told him we don't have much time. He knows this is urgent. He said yes. He agreed to come with me. Maybe you're thinking, okay, fine. Jesus had to heal someone else along the way because apparently he does that kind of thing a lot. But the miracle is done. Let's go. The healing has happened. Let's keep moving. So if you're Jairus, just a heads up, it actually gets worse for you. It gets worse before it gets better. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask who touched me?" So they get a bit sassy there. Jesus kept looking around. No. Jesus kept looking around and looking and looking to see who had done it. Clearly, Jesus is not in a hurry to get to Jairus' house. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. Verse 34, he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While he was still speaking, while this whole other scene is playing out with the woman, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Like, what's the point now that she's died? So Jesus delays over Jairus, kind of like he delayed another time when his friend Lazarus was really sick and needed help. And Jesus wasn't in a big hurry then either. So there's this tension. Jesus obviously cares. He's obviously moved by our request. He's willing to do what you want. He just doesn't always do what you want. Verse 36, overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe." Can you imagine telling Jairus this? "Would you like me to paddle across the Pacific Ocean in a cardboard boat while I'm at it?" He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." So Jesus just says, matter-of-factly, whoa, the child's not dead, she's sleeping. And Mark says, they don't just respond, kind of like I think they'd respond with, "That's impossible." It's more than that. They're incredulous at this point. Verse 40 says, but they laughed at him. Picture that. They stop their weeping and their wailing, and they laugh at Jesus. That's kind of next level, isn't it? I kind of imagine with that connotation that they're mocking him. Okay, Jesus, good one. She's sleeping, right? Why don't we just wake her up and make her breakfast then? You can feel that energy, right? After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Again, if you're Jairus, you ask Jesus to come lay his hands on your daughter, and he's done exactly what he said he would, sort of. But it's a little bit late, right? In some ways, it's almost painful to watch. Verse 42, immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. By the way, the girl is 12, Mark says. How long in the previous scene had the woman with the bleeding issue been suffering? For 12 years. And I don't even know what all that means, other than to say these two stories are definitely connected, and that the woman has been suffering for as long as this girl has been alive. At this, they were completely astonished. Here's one of the reasons why I love Jesus. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them, "Hey, guys, maybe it's time to get her that breakfast you were talking about a minute ago." Yeah. What an amazing pair of stories. Jesus does what people want, just not always in the way they expected. there are some really fascinating similarities and differences between these two miracles. Similarities, they're both about women. One of them is a powerless woman, a girl, right, who has her father acting and speaking for her. The other is a very independent woman, and in fact, more independent than perhaps you might realize. For the woman, her sickness, just a little context here, is such that she would have been labeled unclean by her community. Leviticus chapter 15 is a whole chapter dealing with this issue of blood. And ladies, don't worry, men, we get our own chapter too. In the Old Testament and around the time of Jesus, a woman who was menstruating was called a zab, Z-A-B. You would be ritually unclean for 7 days. In the meantime, or during that time, a woman who is a zab defiles everything she touches. She must not touch other people. She must not sit on anyone's furniture. If she enters a room and water is uncovered, it must be immediately covered. She can't share food. She can't share a bed. All of this means a zab would, of course, be excluded from social gatherings. Even more than that, she can't enter the temple or the local synagogue until after she's finished the 7-day ritual cleansing. That's just the Old Testament law. There's also a great deal of superstition culturally around this. We have an important document, actually, written in the first century by a Roman historian, naturalist, philosopher named Pliny the Elder. I think that's him. And this guy Pliny, he set out to write essentially the world's first encyclopedia, and it's called Natural History. It's 36 volumes long, and in it, Pliny, he compiles all of this information, stuff about geography and anatomy and insects and geology and in medicine, you name it. And some of it would stand as like somewhat scientific by our standards today, but a lot of it devolves into this weird pseudoscience, essentially superstition. But he tried, okay? Pliny lived around the time of Jesus in the first century. Rome, of course, at this time controlled Palestine where Jesus lived. Roman culture influenced everything. And so there's no reason to think that the sentiments that he expresses on this issue hadn't made their way, if not already, into the world of Jesus. Pliny writes in volume 7 of Natural History, and this is a real gem, folks. If this doesn't make you want to pick up a copy of Pliny's Natural History and read it cover to cover, I honestly don't know what will. It's a little bit small, but hopefully you can hear this. It would indeed be a difficult matter to find anything which is productive of more marvelous effects than the menstrual discharge. Isn't church fun? On the approach of a woman in this state, seeds which are touched by her become sterile. Grafts wither away. Garden plants are parched up. It's incredible. The fruit will fall from the tree beneath which she sits. Picture a woman walking through an orchard. Thump, 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 brrr, right? That's what he's saying. Her very look, even, will dim the brightness of mirrors, blunt the edge of steel, and take away the polish from ivory. And this is my favorite. A swarm of bees, if looked upon by her, will die immediately. Brass and iron will instantly become rusty. What I'm saying is Pliny, he just kind of had a way with women. Okay? So with all of this religious and cultural stigma around this issue, now you can see why this woman in Mark 5 is creeping up, creeping around the crowd, sneaking up behind Jesus. According to their religion, their rules, and their culture, she shouldn't even be with them. She should be at home by herself. Not in crowds, bumping into people, let alone purposefully touching them. We don't have anything like this, hardly. I mean, the closest thing I can think of is, remember like during the height of COVID or somewhat now, when you accidentally cough in public? Like, oh, I'm so sorry, right? So times a million is what she experienced. So she's not a part of the community. She's permanently cut off from the life of the synagogue, the hub of the community. By the way, who presides over that synagogue? Jairus, the local synagogue leader. This woman's condition is such that this is her permanent status. She has lived with this stigma every day for 12 years. She's likely never been married. If she had been, her husband for sure divorced her because of this. And so she has indeed, as Mark says, suffered a great deal. And in her pain, in her desperation, and with a whole bunch of shame, she sneaks out and she says to herself, if I just secretly touch his cloak, I'll be healed. Now, if I were Jesus, a good Jewish rabbi, I would stop and I would say, I know why you're here, but theologically, there's a couple of issues we got to address. He could have said, I'm willing to heal you. First of all, let's do away with this magic nonsense. He could have said, there are some things you need to understand, young lady. He could have said, you're going around making everyone else unclean, including me. But he doesn't. Instead, Jesus does what she wants. He lets it happen, just not quite in the way she was hoping for. In Luke's version of the story, he says, then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In other words, she wanted to touch Jesus, get healed, and then sneak away. And you can see why that was her big plan, right? And Jesus goes, not so fast. And this whole time, remember, Jairus is still waiting. Other things have to happen first. Jairus, you've got to wait. In other words, Jesus is willing to give you what you want. He just doesn't always do it the way that you want. So Jairus is waiting, and Jesus, in front of this massive crowd, just imagine this, he won't let it go. Which one of you touched me? Seeing that she couldn't get away unnoticed, she came, fell at his feet, trembling with fear, told him everything. My question is, what is Jesus doing? Why does Jesus, in the moment this woman is trembling and terrified, why does he turn the spotlight on her? Why all of this awkward, unwanted attention? Do you realize this is her worst nightmare? This, what's happening right now. Why does Jesus call her out like that? Luke emphasizes, in the presence of all the people, everybody's there, the whole village. Is Jesus just trying to embarrass her? Is he trying to humiliate her? No, in fact, the opposite. Jesus actually is not being insensitive. What if Jesus knows more of this woman's pain and shame and suffering than she can imagine? What if Jesus knows this is actually the only way to truly help her? I mean, she comes to Jesus hoping for this much. I'd be fine. I'd be overjoyed with this. And Jesus says, that's fine, but I'm going to give you this much. There's so much more. So Jesus does what she wants, but he does it in a way she definitely does not want. She's thinking about her own physical suffering and just relief, and that's all that she has on her mind. At this point, she's not even thinking about the social repercussions, the religious repercussions of her condition. Think about it. Her issue with the bleeding, that's pretty personal. It's pretty private, right? How else are people going to know she's been healed? In this day, because of this system, she does not get to announce, okay, everybody, all better now, I'm fine, back to normal. Because with issues of ceremonial uncleanness, which is what this is, you actually have to run everything through the local synagogue. They're in charge of that. Proving that she has been healed, proving it, so that her stigma can be removed, so that she can be officially. To men like Jairus, who are in charge of this area, can you see how that's a bit complicated, if not invasive, right? You get it? Here's why Jesus does what he does. He knows that by having her share her story in front of everyone, that way she's restored to the community. There in front of everyone, Jesus says, you're healed. In front of everyone, he affirms, she herself gives witness. Jesus also says, it's not my clothes, your faith has healed you. In other words, he singles her out, not for her shameful secret, which is what she thought was going to happen. He singles her out and he commends her for her faith. He says in front of everyone, I'm for you, I believe in you, I'm willing to do what you want. But we don't leave it there. In hindsight, of course, she realizes Jesus not only heals her, he publicly restores her to the community. He removes her stigma. In her moment of deepest shame, Jesus restores her dignity to the village. No more reason to be isolated, no more reason to be afraid. And my question is this: how brilliant, how compassionate, how sensitive is Jesus? He calls her daughter. There's something extraordinary to me about this woman who's been locked up in shame for 12 years. Not just physical discomfort, but emotional, psychological, social shame and alienation. And Jesus just proclaims in front of a whole crowd, this is my daughter. I want you all to know. I mean, that's like the most important word in the whole sentence. Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Jairus, yes? Let the record show. Let the official record show. She's restored. Jesus communicates to this woman in such a profound, loving way. There's no reason to be afraid. I see you. I know you're suffering. I'm willing to do what you want because I'm good. I'm just not going to do it exactly the way that you want. But you can trust me in your moment of desperation to take care of all the details. In other words, Jesus knows what this woman needs. Stuff she hasn't even begun to think through. Jesus is already there. He's way out in front. He's way ahead of her. He doesn't just heal her. He cares enough about her to preserve her dignity. And I'm just telling you, I think there are some of us here who don't believe that's what God is like. Because we think, or we've been told, we come to him and he is going to respond with condemnation. He's going to respond with, I told you so, or what were you thinking, or any other litany of things that make us feel worse than we already feel. Jesus, for this woman in her moment of total vulnerability, he holds up her dignity. He restores her dignity. Doesn't that make you love Jesus? It's amazing. Again, if you're Jairus, because we keep forgetting about him, what are you doing while this whole thing, and it had to have taken some time, is playing out? Are you pacing back and forth, looking at your watch, going, come on, come on, come on? Or are you rejoicing? Are you being amazed at what's happening to other people? People in this case, not as sophisticated, not as smart, not as influential as you are. People who are stupid enough to believe that magic is going to save them. Because guess what? Jesus saves them. Jesus believes in them. His wholeness, his beauty is flowing. Notice the difference between these two miracles. In the first one with the woman, in a very public setting, this independent woman is affirmed and made to speak. Actually, made to speak to a man, and there's no way you could know how crazy that is in this culture. Notice with the woman, the disciples are going, Jesus, what do you mean someone touched you? Notice in this story, Jesus seems very concerned with semantics. No, he insists. There's touching me, which is what everyone's doing, and then there's touching me. Huh? Yeah, what this woman specifically is doing. He publicly calls her out in order to restore her publicly to the community, that the whole village witnesses this miracle. But then when Jesus goes to the house of Jairus and his daughter, let me ask you, is that public or private? It's private. He takes the exact opposite approach. He kicks almost everybody out. Isn't that interesting? He allows for only a few witnesses. Mark says he went in. He said, why all this commotion? Child is not dead, but asleep. After he put them all out. Notice Jesus says the child is not dead, but asleep before he's even seen the child. He hasn't even gone in to see the body yet. My question is, why does Jesus downplay? That's what he's doing. He's downplaying this miracle. Why does Jesus allow only a few witnesses in this case? Now, what's interesting about this, by the way, is in the scene right before, Jesus was willing to split hairs between touching and touching. It's very important that we get this straight. And then in the very next scene, he's like, sleeping, death, eh. Everyone knows those are two very distinct categories. He downplays it. He makes it private. There's some mystery here, but one explanation for it is this. By doing it this way, this girl is restored to her community, because Jesus is all about restoration. And he does it in a way without her having to be this weirdo girl back from the dead, which, by the way, would have been just as unusual for them as it was for us. As it is for us. So I think in order to protect her, he downplays the whole thing, which, by the way, means he diminishes the credit that he could have gotten for a pretty amazing miracle. Mark says he tells the family, don't tell anybody about what's happened here. And then Jesus walks out and goes, all right, everyone, like I said, the whole thing's way overblown. She was, in fact, just sleeping after all. And so, show's over, folks. Nothing to see here. Let's move along. This way, she can keep being a normal girl. No shame. See what he does? No stigma. No zombie girl nicknames at recess. Again, Jesus is brilliant. He actually thinks of everything. I know you probably know that he's good. Did you know he's this good? Jesus meets us where we are. He knows that each situation is distinct. It's unique. That each situation calls for a different response because he's dealing with people. He sees the individual, the person. He's personally invested. On his way to one crisis, he stops to fully address another in a different way. And in both cases, he is way out in front of the whole situation. He's way ahead of everyone. He's thinking of things people won't think about for a long time. They haven't even considered. And he's willing to do what you want him to do. He's available. He's willing. He's for you. He is on your side. Now, he doesn't always do it the way you want. And maybe not yet. But ask him. Jesus, lay hands on my problem. Fix my problem. And then sit back and watch him say yes. And then watch him get sidetracked along the way by other people. And then enjoy how important they are to him, how amazingly he deals with others. I like how Mark just tells a story and then moves on. And we got to wrestle with it, which is why I wish we were sitting in a lodge around couches. I imagine this story hits us all differently. That's what it does. Some of us, I think, are probably like Jairus. And you are convinced fundamentally that God doesn't really see you, doesn't really care about what you're going through. Yeah, he's like the cosmic, he's the universe, all that stuff, but he's not personally invested in what's going on. Again, maybe you're in a desperate situation. You need help. It's a health issue, a marriage that's falling apart, financial, whatever. And you don't know how you're going to make it. It is interesting, the things that we all carry with us, right, in a place like this. And you wonder, does God care? Like Jairus trying to interrupt, is he too busy to be available? Or you watch God answer other people's prayers, and you wonder, when's it going to be my turn? You ever do that? When's he going to do something for me? And I just want to remind you that Jesus sees you, that he cares deeply, that he wants to meet you in your desperation. He's willing. He doesn't always do what we want, but he's good. We can trust him. In fact, he's thinking of things we haven't even begun to think about. Which, by the way, that actually frees us up to celebrate, instead of being bitter, to celebrate what God does in the lives of people around us. I want to remind you that nothing can separate you from his love, from his presence. Not hardship, not difficulty, not anxiety over the future, not a difficult marriage, not trouble with your kids, not loneliness. Nothing can separate you from his love. He sees you. Perhaps others of us are more like the woman in the story. And we come in this morning and we have secrets. We have shame. Things that have been done to you through no fault of your own and the pain that that's caused. Others of us, we've made choices and we've failed and we have regret. And we're also desperate. And we come to Jesus and we don't know how he's going to receive us in our need. We kind of expect more judgment, more anger, more condemnation. And there's people here who I'm guessing feel really unlovable and unworthy. And so the question to you or to me is, will we risk being, what that woman does is incredibly courageous. To risk exposure, to risk being fully known for who we really are. Again, Jesus is better than you think. He sees all of it and loves you anyway. He's good, like the story with the woman. He's good enough to preserve your dignity, and you can trust him with that. Tim Keller says, to be loved but not known is comforting but superficial. To be known and not loved, well, that is our greatest fear. But to be fully known and truly loved is, well, a lot like being loved by God. It liberates us from pretense, humbles us out of our self-righteousness, and fortifies us for any difficulty life can throw at us. What's he saying? That whatever it is you are carrying, wherever you're feeling desperate, in a relationship, in a circumstance, in an area of shame or failure or weakness or inadequacy, this is the reality, that you are fully known and truly loved. That's what Jesus is offering. In both of these stories that we read, Jairus and the woman, they don't know what's going to happen when they approach Jesus. They don't know if he'll care. They don't know if he's willing to help. All they know is they don't have any better ideas, and so they decide to take a risk. And that's what this is. For Jairus, he risks his reputation, maybe his career. The woman risks embarrassment and humiliation. They both risk the possibility of rejection. But they both come to the conclusion that Jesus is worth that risk. All I'm saying is I think Mark, in telling us this, is hoping that we will come to the same conclusion for ourselves. That whatever it is you're carrying, wherever you need help, wherever you're desperate, wherever you're praying and wondering if God cares, wherever you feel ashamed, wherever you feel like, man, if people really knew this about me, there's no way they'd stick around. Will you take the risk with that to come to Jesus and to be fully known? I think what Mark is saying is listen, there's actually still room for all of us to creep up, not creepy way, but to creep up behind Jesus, if that's all you can do, right? And to take a risk with that odd mixture of fear and faith that kind of describes our lives, right? To reach out and to touch him. I can say all I want about why Jesus is good, why I love Jesus, why you should too, but the point is, until you discover this, you're going to miss it. We trust him with our whole selves, with our deepest fears, our deepest inadequacies, knowing that he sees it all and he loves us anyway. That has to be experienced. You've got to take the risk. Would you stand with me? We'll pray. Heavenly Father, as we think about our own areas of desperation, Lord, we want answers. We want you to fix things or make other things go away or whatever it is we want to happen. And Father, we sometimes miss this huge truth that in all of that, in spite of all of that, some of which will never be fixed until Jesus returns, you love us fully. You know us fully. And you love us in spite of that. Father, help us to rest, to actually find peace and calmness and just like this sigh of relief in that great truth. Thank you for this reminder that you see us, the parts that we're hiding, the parts that we're afraid other people are going to find out, things we're ashamed of. You see all of that, and you love us anyway, and you respond that your desire is to restore our dignity. Thank you for being willing to do what we want because you care, because you're good. Help us to trust you when you don't always do what we want. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, thanks, everyone. We're going to wrap this up next week, so please don't miss that. We'll see you then. Have a great week.